Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts, beginning December 4th. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
Rising waters impact on space exploration and history. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. Kennedy Space Center houses critical launch infrastructure for civilian, military, and commercial space use. Its geographic location, surrounded by water, is designed for public safety, but it's also one of the launch facility's biggest threats. The current solutions are temporary, and the agency is racing to come up with a permanent solution to rising waters or risk losing America's access to space. As part of our series Central Florida Seen and Heard, Rising Waters, we'll explore those risks and what NASA is doing to protect the country's doorway to space. Then, the Space Coast's storied history is at risk of washing away. Anthropologists at the University of Central Florida are racing against the clock to uncover and catalog early evidence of the U.S. space program. We'll hear from one UCF professor about those efforts. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Florida is well known for being a space hub, with rockets routinely blasting off into orbit. Kennedy Space Center's location is intentional. Surrounded by water on all sides, it offers a safe way to launch rockets from the U.S. But that geography is one of its greatest threats. Rising sea levels, flooding, and erosion threaten Florida's spaceport, and the Kennedy Space Center is trying to fight back. Here to talk about how KSC is trying to protect the Space Coast is the Director of Center Planning and Development for Kennedy Space Center, Tom Engler. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
This series is looking at the threats of rising water, both coastal intrusion and inland flooding here in Central Florida. Along the Space Coast at the Kennedy Space Center where you are, just what are those threats?
The biggest concerns that we have would include sea level rise and the large storms that are starting to happen more frequently. We kind of got the warning call a few years ago with Superstorm Sandy. We had a significant amount of erosion along our beach and the dune line that we have here. We have gone into a significant planning effort to try to deal with those threats as they are developing.
When you look at a map, the Kennedy Space Center sits on some quite unique geography. It's, you know, wedged between the Atlantic Ocean on the east, Banana River to the south, and you got the Indian River to the west and the north. This geographic location is by design, right? This is the best place to have a launch facility, correct?
We are right next to the ocean. And so early on, as the American rocket program was developing, the biggest concern was hazards to the public and ensuring that as we do launches, and that remains the concern currently, that the risk to the public is minimized. So by definition, being next to an ocean and launching over that ocean minimizes that risk.
But with that comes risk to the infrastructure, right? As you outlined earlier, the sea is trying to take it back, is it not?
It's a constant battle, yes. You see it all over the world. You've got people worrying about beach restoration. We spent significant funds to restore the dunes that were damaged during Superstorm Sandy. We've gone and done a significant project to build up the dune structure that basically goes from just north of Launch Complex 39B to just in front of Launch Complex 41. And so that has helped to protect the infrastructure that we have here from the storms that have popped up, you know, over the last few years.
When designing those launch pads to begin with, what kind of mitigation efforts were there? Were designers thinking about this constant threat of coastal erosion?
I would say that the biggest thing they did, just because of the proximity to groundwater, if you look at 39A and B as an example, and all of the launch sites, they're all elevated. That was just because you're in Florida, and if you dig 3 feet into the ground, you're going to strike water. And so that was a big concern here. If I recall correctly, the average height of Kennedy Space Center is somewhere around 6 feet above sea level. So we are close to water. So that is a constant concern for us in ensuring that the infrastructure we have here is hardened and protected to the maximum extent.
So essentially, there's water on all sides and below. You're constantly dealing with water. Tell me a bit about the dunes. You mentioned that you built up the dunes after Superstorm Sandy. What does this kind of protection look like? And can you explain what the dunes are and what they're doing to protect these pads?
Basically, what they're there for is as the storms come by, either offshore or come onto shore, they are there to effectively protect the infrastructure against the waves that are generated during a storm. We've experienced several storms since the dunes were put together. Proud to say for the team that designed the dune restoration project that the dunes have held up really well. That part has worked well. And again, the intent was to protect the infrastructure that sits on the other side of the water from the dunes. And so far that's gone really well. It's not a guarantee. It is one of the mitigation measures that we need to be looking at long-term for us.
What are some other mitigation measures you're thinking about long-term?
There is a road, it's called Phillips Parkway, that kind of goes north-south between the dunes and the launch sites. So one of the things we're looking at is the elevation of that road to act as a secondary barrier. Another one is further hardening of the dunes and expansion of the dune project and infrastructure that will, again, provide additional capability to protect against the storm surges and things that could happen during a hurricane. And so those are probably the two biggest projects, but as we're looking to build new structures, we have to ensure that we are building those in areas that are higher than we have been worrying about before. So as part of our planning process, we have taken a look at all the different factors that would affect the type of construction we're doing, which not just includes sea level rise and the existing wetlands that we have, but threatening endangered species and factors like that. So we've actually narrowed down our development areas into a few small areas that allows us to basically protect against all of those different factors, including sea level rise and potential for those larger storms.
KSC's focus over the past decade or so has been to become a multi-user spaceport, which includes those commercial companies. SpaceX is using one of those pads that you mentioned. Has the threat of water intrusion played a role in the development of KSC? You know, in other words, are commercial companies thinking about this as a problem in the future? And how is Kennedy Space Center reassuring those companies that it's under control?
I think as we're looking to allow further development of the center, we're limiting development to those areas that are least risk. I don't know that we can ever say truly that it's under control, but we are trying to ensure that any of the development that we do allow to happen here incorporates those concerns, and that we are, you know, working with the private companies that are coming in and doing the development work, whether it's Blue Origin and Exploration Park or OneWeb or SpaceX, the other companies that are coming out here to do work, working with them on designs and all that tries to minimize those effects to the maximum extent possible. But again, our biggest mitigation right now is just to limit the areas that the development can occur in so that issues with water continue to grow, that those are minimized with any new development that occurs here on center.
Tom, a Bloomberg analysis last year found rising seas will cost federal facilities some $387 billion. Merritt Island and Kennedy Space Center is likely to face one major flood a year and minor floods every week. Do you look at this at a cost perspective, and is there a price tag to this? And is that driving some of these efforts to prevent some of the damages done by rising waters?
Well, as you would expect, there's a price tag with all of these kind of mitigations that are going on, with the exception of just, you know, pure facility siting. But there are significant price tags that would be attached to any of the mitigations that I mentioned earlier, whether it's raising the roadbed, additional dune structures, those kinds of things, and they're not insignificant. We are working to incorporate that planning into our overall construction of facilities planning for the center and for the agency, so that we are ensuring that people understand what we're facing, what we need to do, and that as money becomes available, we're able to implement the projects that we can with the money that's available at the time.
Like Kennedy Space Center and the Space Coast's launch infrastructure is extremely unique, and it's not anywhere else, right? I mean, you really have to protect this at all costs, right?
I will say that one of the things that the center that we can be proud of, and you know, the state of Florida as a whole and nation, is that the environment that we've created here since the end of the shuttle program is one that exists nowhere else in the world. We have four companies here doing human spaceflight activities, SpaceX, Blue Origin, Lockheed Martin, and Boeing, and there's nowhere else in the world that goes on. And as we look to continue to, and I'll say, when I say we, I include the Space Force Station with this, there's a large number of launch service providers that are coming in because we have access to the ocean. As you mentioned, the ability to launch over the ocean is a significant enabler for commercial space companies. And then the access to the airspace that we have, that we're able to clear that to orbit effectively to enable these launches. Yeah, and there's very few places in the world that kind of environment exists. And so as you look at the changes that have happened since the end of the shuttle program here at the Space Center and the spaceport as a whole, they've been massive. And this is the new space age that we're looking at, and it's centered here. I mean, it really is. The infrastructure that's here, the intellectual property, for lack of a better term, everything that's happening here is basically priceless. I mean, there's no other way of saying it. So we definitely need to protect it the best as we can and ensure that the advantages that have been gained by opening up our space center to commercial companies continues to pay dividends and really benefit the American public as a whole. And it's again, it's been significant. It's something to really be proud of. And like I said, that this environment exists nowhere else in the world.
You mentioned there is a significant cost. This is a relentless battle that does not seem to be pulling back at all. But I have to think that, you know, NASA is one of the agencies leading the charge in observing and tracking climate change and sea level rise. Does this give you a bit of a leg up in this fight, knowing that you've got these NASA resources on your side to help protect the sites that launch these NASA resources?
I think everything helps. We're working, you know, across the federal government with the different agencies that are looking at that. Certainly the work that NASA is doing, along with NOAA and other federal agencies, to understand what is happening and how it's affecting us will help to deal with the consequences of these different things that are happening, whether it's stronger storms or sea level rise, the flooding that comes with all that. As a nation, you know, as a state of Florida, Brevard County, I mean, there's been a lot of work that's gone in at all levels, and it's pretty amazing. Again, in the grand scheme of things, understanding this, realizing what we have here and making sure that we don't have an adverse effect to it, I think that's probably the thing that's, to me, the most important out of all this.
With that said, I mean, do you feel like you are getting more support because of some of the historic storms that we've gotten, like with Ian and Nicole and Idalia?
Any time that those have happened, we've been able to get the funding we need to fix and kind of prepare for the next one, fix what's broken and maybe get a little ahead of it for the next one. So again, the Dune project came out of Superstorm Sandy funds. So, and we've had things that have come in and we've been able to do some hardening, you know, localized hardening in areas that have been damaged. So is it the total answer? No, there is going to have to be at some point a larger reckoning, especially for coastal areas, that needs to really take a look at what needs to be done to harden overall, kind of a federal and a congressional level. We're doing what we can to prepare for it, and so far we've gotten good support, but do we have everything we need right now? No. Hopefully it's coming.
Tom Engler is Director of Center Planning and Development for Kennedy Space Center. Tom, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, saving Florida's Space Coast history from rising water. That's ahead when Are We There Yet continues. You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Anthropologists in Central Florida are trying to preserve the history that is scattered along the Space Coast. Once dry artifacts are now soaked in water. Some of that history now underwater includes ancient pottery and village sites from pre-contact times thousands of years ago. And recent history, like evidence of the space race of the 1950s and 60s, is also at risk. UCF anthropologist and professor Stacy Barber is trying to dig up that history before the water takes it. While water can help preserve some artifacts, when water creeps in on previously dry sites, the water can change the artifacts completely. Stacy Barber now joins us now to talk more about her and her team's efforts to save history from rising water. Stacy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we dive too deep into the issue of water and your work, let's talk about your work in general. What are you doing out on the Space Coast?
So I am part of a research team that includes myself and two other anthropology professors at UCF, and then the Space Launch Delta 45 Cultural Resource Manager. And together, we are investigating archaeological sites on the barrier island that is occupied by the Cape Canaveral Space Force Station, documenting everything we can about these sites because they're in low-lying areas and are at high risk of inundation from sea level rise and increasingly severe storm surges.
What are some of the things that you are looking for there? You think of an archaeological dig site of Cape Canaveral and you think, well, I was bumping in the 1960s. Are you looking at for those historical things or even before that?
So both, actually. Anything over 50 years old can be considered archaeological. So I'm sorry to all of your listeners.
I'm close.
I know, exactly. Soon to be myself, who are technically archaeological. So we do everything from the peak pre-contact period. So that's going to be anything before about 1565. And then also anything after that time period that dates up until about 1955.
What are some of the things that you're uncovering? What was there pre-contact?
There was a ton of stuff here pre-contact. So lagoons are one of the best ecosystems for human beings to live around because essentially you just have fish in a barrel. There's just so much food, and ecosystems like the Indian River Lagoon, which until very recently were among the most diverse in North America, provide all kinds of resources. And so humans have lived on lagoons for thousands of years. And obviously, I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with the Windover site in Titusville, which is on the west coast, on the mainland of the Indian River Lagoon. And that site is 10,000 years old. So people have been living in that area for a really long time.
And you're finding archaeological evidence of that, huh?
Absolutely. So we have everything from what would be called a midden site, which is essentially a place where refuse was deposited from shell fishing or fishing, to mound sites where people intentionally built mounds to bury ancestral individuals, so pre-contact burial sites, to really ephemeral stuff like, oh, somebody came in and like got a bunch of shellfish from the oyster reef, chucked the oysters here and went on their way. So a wide range of archaeological sites.
And then closer to our time, you're looking at the early days of the space program, right? The historic missile facilities and stuff like that were around in the mid-20th century, right?
Yes. So we actually, one of the first sites that we investigated was actually the original lighthouse site for the Cape Canaveral Lighthouse. You may be aware that the lighthouse was relocated because of its proximity to shore. There was concern that it was not going to survive hurricanes. So we've investigated the pad of the original lighthouse. And then just this past year and the year before, we've been looking at the bumper missile launch pad, which is having its 75th anniversary next year. So we identified the concrete foundation of the control building from which the missile was originally launched. And I have to say, OSHA would be horrified at the conditions. So they were really close to where the missiles were going off back in the 1950s.
Okay. I mean, well, yeah, 75-year-old missile, you know, silo. Yeah, I see that.
Yes.
What do we stand to lose when it comes to the history of the U.S. space program if this work isn't done in time before the water washes it away?
And the water will probably hit some of the historic launch pads eventually. The space program is sort of fundamental to 21st century society, right? It is, Cape Canaveral literally holds the physical remnants of this incredible technological development that our species, human beings, made in the 20th century. We went from a planet-bound species to an interplanetary species, right? We are sending probes to Mars. We've sent humans to the moon. I mean, these are incredible accomplishments. And but they didn't happen overnight. They were work. And we don't want to forget the steps that are required to get from a rocket during the Second World War to Neil Armstrong. Like, that was an incredible amount of hard work. And the launch pads and the facilities that controlled the rockets and the other components of the space program are literally just sitting on the surface at Cape Canaveral. And if we lose those, we lose all the details of how people created the infrastructure to allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm. When you look at I'm thinking specifically of kind of Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral. You look at the geography of it. You've got the Atlantic Ocean on the east, and then you've got bodies of water surrounding it all the time, on all other ends. And then there's also water coming up from the aquifer underneath. Forgive me, because my experience with anthropology is what I get from watching movies. You see, it's a lot of you're brushing off dirt and dust and taking things, but really in these particular dig sites, you're dealing with water, right? Tell us a bit about the risk that water has on these historic artifacts that you're looking to find.
Water is really interesting. It can be good and bad. Watery environments can actually preserve archaeological materials, like the Wendover site, where you had incredible organic preservation because there was very low oxygen.
And that's where you're seeing like evidence of the shellfishers and stuff, right?
So the Wendover site, which was excavated many years ago in Titusville, was a swamp site, and the sediment was saturated with water, and so things like cloth and hair and fingernails preserve.
Really?
So water can be this real boon to archaeology. However, if the site is dry and then water starts to creep into the site, when you have that change in conditions, that's when you really see destruction of sites. We are also finding, as water rises, that the archaeological remains that previously were dry land are now inundated. So when we look at, say, a village site, which we have many examples of, the Cape Canaveral area was occupied by hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the pre-contact period. The archaeological sites now go out into the Indian River Lagoon. So when I want to know the limits of the site, I got to take off my boots and I got to roll up my pants and I got to wade out into the water, and I'm finding ancient pottery. I'm finding ancient shells.
In the Indian River Lagoon today?
In itself. Absolutely. Yep. You just walk out into the water. The water might be 6, 8, 24 inches deep, and you'll pick artifacts up off the bottom.
But in this case, that's a bad thing, right?
Yes, because those materials used to be dry and now they're saturated. And what happens is the salt from the salt water gets microscopically into the materials. And if that material gets picked up out of the water, the salts recrystallize and changes the molecular structure of the material, and it starts to slough. When the surface of something starts to slough away because salt is drying out and crystallizing inside of it. Yep.
What are we losing? What could we lose as these events happen more frequently and with greater severity?
So that's a really, it's almost like a philosophical
question. Right, yeah, it is. Yeah, what do we stand to lose? Yeah.
And that really, so what you're asking me is, what do the remains of our past mean to us, right? Because when we lose them by something like storm surge or sea level rise, both of which are happening on Cape Canaveral, we are losing parts of the past. And one of the things I typically say when someone asks me this question is, well, why is memory loss a problem? For anyone at an individual level, at a collective level, our past is our memory. And we don't know who we are if we don't know where we've come from. The people who lived on the Indian River Lagoon prior to Spanish arrival are unfortunately not the ancestors of the vast majority of Floridians today. However, the people who lived pre-contact on the Indian River Lagoon were the people who created the lagoon that we inherited today, right? They're the ones who cared for the oyster reefs. They're the ones who created the original fishery. They're the ones who shaped the shoreline where their villages were located, where their ancestors were buried. So we have inherited a place that was already managed by people and that was already inhabited by people. And that lagoon is what created the lagoon we have today, the mix of species that are present, some of the waterways. All of our knowledge of that lagoon comes from the way that it was used and managed by people pre-contact.
So you lose that history of the keepers and creators of this beautiful space that have led to such developments that we see now.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to go back to, you mentioned the bumper site, because I think that's just one kind of anecdote about our history that we are discovering that is so close to present time. And we do risk losing that because of water. Is there anything that can be done to slow this down? Or, I mean, this is a constant battle that we're going to be having with the ocean trying to take back the land, right? Is there any way to slow it down so that you can continue this work?
So I should say the barrier islands are going to continue to be there regardless of sea level rise. Barrier islands are notoriously shifty, right? That's what they do. They move and they change. If we could solve the problem of sea level rise and superstorms, I'm pretty sure that I would not be a college professor anymore, right?
Controlling the weather, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, there are certainly a lot of really smart people trying to solve these problems. Some of them are infrastructural. You know, do we change the landscape, increasing mangrove plantings, as one of my colleagues at UCF is in the biology department is doing? Do we build hard infrastructure? Do we build walls, which is something that the Space Force, I think, has talked about? You'd have to check with them. But, you know, do we protect things like launch pads by building barrier walls or redirecting the movement of water? Some of that can be done. I can't lift the barrier islands out of the sea. Like, I can't make them higher. And they're really, really low-lying land. And storm surges aren't going to get smaller in the future. I mean, that's just not what's going to happen. Some of it is out of our control, right? We can't affect the angle of the Earth towards the sun that causes the warming, that causes some of the ocean problems. We could maybe drive around a little less, redo infrastructure here in Central Florida to reduce our carbon footprint. I mean, there are things like that that can be done. Mm-hmm. But in the short term, what I can do is I can dig these sites and document these sites before they get washed away, in the hopes that while the sites may be gone, the materials that were in them are protected in climate control conditions, and we have my field notes and we have my radiocarbon dates and all of those things to allow future researchers to continue to understand and build on our knowledge of that past.
So you have to get it before the water does.
Absolutely.
A race against time and watering.
It is a race against time and water, yeah.
We've been speaking with Stacy Barber. She's a professor of anthropology at the University of Central Florida. Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. And hear more from our series, Central Florida Seen and Heard, Rising Water, on our website, cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.